And thank all of you for being there. It was a great encouragement. This morning I was thinking about this question. What if there was only one church in the Bible? And what I mean by that is, what if all these Christians, all these churches we read about throughout the New Testament, what if they were all just one church in one location? Now, I understand, in essence, there is a one church, there is a universal church, that universal church never gathers together and worships God. But what if that was the case? And therefore, one Sunday, you went to that church. Imagine the men and the women that you would meet as you were there that Sunday. Well, who would you find there? Who would you encounter and get to know? Well, that's kind of what we want to talk about. Now, a lot of us would probably say, well, the apostles. And that is correct. That would be a neat thing, to meet the 12 apostles who would be part of this church. But we're going to take the apostles and we're going to set them aside. And we're going to think, well, they're apostles. They were very busy talking to other people, and we didn't get to meet them this particular Sunday. But we're going to talk about some other people that we might have met as we visit that. And the whole idea here is to learn some lessons. Specifically, a great lesson is because I have a feeling that sometimes there is this feeling that some people have, that I'm a very small, insignificant part of a congregation, and that there's really not much that I can do. And the unfortunate thing is that sometimes that's exactly what they do. They do very little. And I want to encourage you that what you do, what you have as a talent to use for God, is very, very important. The people of the New Testament, some of them are named. Some of them are described for us, and what some things about them are highlighted for us. And what that tells me is that these inspired writers, that in essence God, through these writers, wanted us to know about these people. There are others that are described but not named. And what that tells us about them, well, there's a lesson in that. There's something that God wanted us to know about these people. And so, that's what we're going to look at. A few people in the New Testament. People that if it was one congregation, who we would have met. One of the things I think is very intriguing is a Christian by the name of Dorcas. Let's go over to Acts chapter 9, verse 36. As we try to kind of put this together kind of figuratively, we went to this church and we would meet this woman. And it's kind of remarkable that she would be at church this particular Sunday because of what we read here. Acts 9, beginning verse 36. Now in Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. And this woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. And it happened at that time that she fell sick and died. And when they had washed her body, they laid it in an upper room. I'm going to repeat that just for emphasis. They laid her in an upper room. Since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two men to him, imploring him, "Do not delay in coming to us." So Peter arose and he went with them. And when he arrived, they brought him into the upper room. And all the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. But Peter sent them all out, and he knelt down and he prayed. And turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand, and he raised her up, and calling the saints and the widows, he presented her alive. And it became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. In our little fantasy idea here, the reason it was amazing that we could meet Dorcas is that she had just died, but Peter had resurrected her. And I think it's interesting that as Luke is telling us about the history of the church and telling us about the spread of the gospel, that he decides to tell us about Tabitha. He says, listen, let me tell you a little bit about a Christian woman by the name of Tabitha, which was her Hebrew or Aramaic name. Dorcas is what it would translate into Greek. And this name means gazelle. I don't know if there's any big significance to that, but that's what that means. But what is highlighted about Dorcas? Well, I think a lot of us would say, well, it's the fact that she's resurrected from the dead. Well, yeah, I think that's a big reason. But why? Why does she become this resurrected person in the New Testament? It's because of what also is highlighted about her, and that is that she has these acts of kindness and charity. In fact, we find out in verse 39 that a lot of this kindness was directed towards widows. And I think it's kind of interesting because there is a distinction that is made. I don't know if this is what is meant, but there is a distinction that is made in verse 41 where Peter presents her, it says, to the saints and to the widows. So widows are distinct of the saints. Now, I don't know if that's just simply saying, well, there is a group of saints that were widows, and they're highlighted here because she helped them, or if it's saying that there are saints that she did charity for, but there's also these non-believer widows. I'm not positive on that, but I think it's interesting that there's that distinction. And that what she did for these widows was she made tunics and garments. Now, I would imagine that Dorcas probably thought that wasn't a big deal. I think she probably enjoyed doing that, helping those widows and the other acts of kindness. But I would imagine Dorcas probably thought, well, you know, that's in the grand scheme of things, that's very little. It's easy for me to do, and the fact that it helps these widows out, well, that's just the icing on the top of the cake. But when you look at the reaction here, even if Dorcas did consider this to be a small, insignificant thing, others did not. As we look at Dorcas, I think there's a little side lesson here that really helps us in the book of Acts, throughout the book of Acts. When we talk about the church doing acts of kindness and charity, what we call benevolence. There's a very big division between our brethren that's been around for years and years and years on this very thing. Is it the church's duty to be a charity, to do charity for all the world, believers and unbelievers? And we take the view that no, there is a distinction that's made between what the church is to be responsible for, those helping the saints, and what Christians, a much wider sense of helping those. Well, this isn't the only place that we find that distinction in the book of Acts, but notice that when it comes to, and again, if these are widows that are not Christian, that even makes it a stronger statement that she is helping people based on what she could do. That she's not saying, oh, I have to have, all my charity has to be done through the church. She's doing what she can do. Earlier we saw Peter and John help a layman, a poor layman, again, based on what they could do. For he was a non-Christian. I think that's a little side lesson, I think, that comes out here. I think when you look at Dorcas, she becomes the epitome of what Paul writes in Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, which again, I don't think it's directed towards a church collective, but an exhortation along with the other exhortations he makes here to individual Christians. Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, where Paul writes, "So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who are of the household of the faith." I think that's a great lesson we learn in Dorcas. But I want you to think about this as well. I want us to get the emphasis of what is so significant about this Christian woman we've just met on this Sunday morning. Peter comes to resurrect her, right? And I would imagine that's why they call Peter. Okay, that I'm not sure they're just wanting him to see a dead Christian. I believe that they call Peter because they believe Peter could do something. That he could raise her. Now, if that be the case, I want you to contrast this story with Dorcas with the raising of Lazarus in John chapter 11. John chapter 11 is an incredible story where Jesus, of course, raises Lazarus. But there's more to that story, right? Where he delays in coming so that Lazarus will die. And that's the whole point. He's going to show everybody that someone doesn't have to be living for me to help them. They can be dead, and I still can take care of that. And remember, it's both Mary and Martha, which I need to point out to you. Mary and Martha are not weak in faith. They are some of the strongest, most loving, most devoted disciples Jesus had. But both of them come up to Jesus, and they said, "If you had been here, you could have done something. You see..." Their faith did place a limitation, and that was the point. Jesus wanted them to go to the next step of faith to know He is the resurrection and the life. He wanted them to understand there is no limitation, not even life versus death. But now, notice the growth of faith of these disciples who, now that she is dead, they didn't call for Peter before this. They call for Peter, now that she's dead, they call for Peter to come. And I would imagine, this is just my own opinion, that they were going to call one of the apostles. If it wasn't Peter, it was going to be another apostle. But Peter happened to be the closest apostle. And so Peter comes and raises her from the dead. Now, why? I mean, you don't hear of these stories where Christians die and they call for an apostle and, "Hey, can you resurrect this dead Christian?" You don't read about stories like that throughout the book of Acts, throughout the New Testament, do you? So why Dorcas? Because of what is highlighted about her. Because of her acts of kindness, the woman that she was. And so Dorcas becomes the first resurrection of the first fruits of the resurrection. The first resurrection since Jesus' resurrection. Here's the point I want you to take from this wonderful woman we've just met. We've just worshiped together in this church. If your talent, your ability, your love for God is acts of kindness and charity, helping others in their time of need, and there are some people that are just geared that way. Their heart just pours out to people more than some of the others. That doesn't mean we're not all charitable, but there are some people that just have that desire and that talent. Please don't think that what you do for the Lord is somehow little and insignificant. they called for Peter to raise her from the dead. And this is what's highlighted about her. It doesn't say, oh, she was converting people left and right. Maybe she was. I don't know. Maybe this is the way that doors were opened. I don't think that's why she was doing it. So if this is your talent, your what you do for the Lord, this is your love for other people, think about Dorcas. God wanted us to know about this woman and why she was so beloved. You know, Dorcas goes, you know, we talked to Dorcas for a while. Now, after services, we also meet Joseph. And you say, well, wait a second. Joseph in the church? I thought Jesus' father died. No, well, there's lots of Josephs in the Bible. Go over, if you would, to Acts 4 as we meet Joseph. Acts chapter 4. And we're going to look at verse 36, where, just so happens, we read about another case where, in this instance, the church collectively is doing benevolence, but they're doing it for needy saints. Just the saints. And we're reading about one of the examples of what's going on, how this benevolence is going on. So in verse 36, now Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, and who owned a tract of land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. That's what a lot of these Christians were doing. This is one example of many of how they were helping the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, as you go to Acts 5, you get the bad example of Ananias and Sapphira. And that does not go well. But we don't know this man by the name of Joseph. We know him better as Barnabas. Bar, son of Nabas, encouragement. But, you know, that name, we kind of misunderstand that name a little bit. Does it mean son of encouragement? Well, yeah. But really, when you look at it, it means son of exhortation. It means son of prophecy. So the encouragement that this word conveys is through preaching or teaching. And so the idea is that Barnabas was this speaker, this teacher, this prophet. He did have the gift of prophecy, as we learn about later. And he was able to exhort and encourage. He was one of those types of preachers who could lay down the law but encourage at the same time. And so don't just think of him as going around and being this great encourager. It relates to his speaking ability. That's what that word really is talking about. Holloman's Bible Dictionary says this means son of prophecy, or one who prophesies or preaches. In other words, a son of exhortation. Nabas is the Aramaic word for prophecy or exhortation. So you put that bar, son of, on that Barnabas, and that's where we get this name. But are we completely off base if we think of him as, you know, not being an encouraging person, even though he's not speaking? I'm not sure if we're completely off base on that. Look, if you would, again, in Acts chapter 4, verse 36 and 37, what is highlighted about him? Well, his character to encourage and exhort. And in this case, his encourage, like Dorcas, to do an act of benevolence, to sell a piece of land and take all of the money that he got, the total purchase price, and give that to the needy by giving it to the apostles, or laying at the apostles' feet. But let's go over to Acts chapter 11, verse 21. This is one of the stories I think is impressive to me as well. and might show that he is a man of encouragement, not just from what we might call the pulpit and his speaking engagement, but look at this. Verse 21, this is talking about this group of Christians that went to Antioch of Syria, and they started preaching to Jews and Gentiles. And when Jerusalem heard of this, well, this is what happened. And the hand of the Lord was with them, if I can put it, in Antioch. And a large number who believed turned to the Lord, Jews and Gentiles. And the news about them reached the ears of the church at Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas off to Antioch. Then, when he arrived and witnessed the grace of God, he rejoiced and began to encourage them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. For he was a good man, and full of the Holy Spirit, and of faith. And considerable numbers were brought to the Lord. Now, a few things I want to point out here. I think it's interesting that when they hear about this success story in Antioch, Jerusalem sends Barnabas. So here comes Barnabas from the very first church among other churches. And here he is sent specifically, probably, by the church, which included apostles and perhaps elders. And he gets down there, and what does he do? He doesn't say, "All right, here I am." He witnesses. That's what it says in verse 23. He arrived and he witnessed. He watched what's going on. He just took it all in. And as a little side note, what did he witness? What was he watching? The grace of God. Now, I don't know, but I think that would help us a lot with this idea that grace has no works. Well, if grace has no works, then what was he witnessing? What was he watching? What was he seeing? But then he was afforded an opportunity, apparently, to speak. And he rejoiced and he encouraged them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. Remember that this is Barnabas who, when Apostle Paul, came to Jerusalem, they didn't want anything to do with him. He is the persecutor. He has come here to cause problems. And Barnabas is the one that gets up and stands for Saul and testifies about Saul, to which now they accept him. Remember that he is the one that in the second missionary journey, when Paul says, "No, don't take John Mark, he deserted us," Barnabas says, "No, we need to give him a second chance." He encourages John Mark and says, "Yes, we know you're ready for this." He gives him time to grow, in which even Paul later on admitted that John Mark was very useful for service to him. And so as we look at Barnabas, let me again say, if you're a Christian and kind of one of your talents, the things you like to do, is go around and encourage people. Maybe it's from a speaking role. Maybe it's just going around and you uplift people and you're encouraging people. You're not ignoring the sin in people, but you're encouraging them to become better people. Please, again, don't think, "Man, that is nothing. You know, I don't teach the Bible class, so I don't do that much." There is a reason that God, through Luke, wanted us to know about Barnabas, the son of encouragement. That'd be kind of neat to meet Barnabas at church. There are other positive examples we can look at. We can look at Phoebe, a female Christian who meant so much to the church in Cenchrea. They sent her on some type of task, some type of mission. She is called a servant of the Cenchrea church. And again, women We correctly make that distinction that we have different roles of the Lord. But please, women, don't think that you can't serve the Lord and that that is a huge thing. Please don't think that somehow your role is less significant or some smaller significance. One of the interesting things about Luke's writing, the next time you go through the gospel and the book of Acts, and maybe you've already noticed this, he really highlights the role of women to the Lord and in the Lord. Aquila and Priscilla, they are the golden married couple. How many married couples are highlighted in the church? Now, that's not to say there were no married couples, but we don't read about them. Even the apostles who brought along a believing spouse, well, we don't read about, you know, their marriage and all of that. But Aquila and Priscilla are always mentioned together, and they always use their marriage in serving the Lord. Isn't that awesome? In fact, I don't know if you remember this, but Paul says in Romans 16, verse 4, that they risked their necks to save his life. So, if your marriage, and you have that talent, you have the ability, where you and your spouse are serving the Lord, whether it's through hospitality, encouragement, studies, whatever it is, please don't think that that's some small, insignificant thing. There's Erastus, who is described as the city treasurer of Corinth. You know, a lot of times people think that the followers of Jesus were just poor, common people. Well, there were a lot of them. But there were also people of high rank, prominent women and men that followed Jesus. Erastus was referred to as the city treasurer. In fact, they have found in archaeology an inscription or a stone of some sort that describes that very thing about Erastus. Now, in 2 Corinthians, I believe Paul sends Timothy on ahead as these different congregations in Macedonia and Greece are making a collection to help the needy saints in Jerusalem. He sends Timothy along with another brother, unnamed. And many believe that that unnamed brother might have been Erastus, who through his experience with being the city treasurer, his experience with finances and money, was sent to help in this situation. Again, if that's something that fits within your ability, your talents, please don't think that that is somehow insignificant. And so if there was one church in all of the New Testament, and we had the pleasure of worshiping with those saints, these would be some of the people that we would meet. Some of the great positive examples. And though some are teachers, that's not what is necessarily highlighted about these people. You don't necessarily have to be a teacher to serve the Lord, but we sure love when you do teach, and we need teachers. Now, as we close, I want to go over to 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14. And this is why I put it as one church. Because I think this helps us with the mental picture of these. Not only would we find all of these positive examples of these Christians, but if we were to visit that one church of the New Testament, we would also find these disciples. Look at what Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. Not only would we find the Dorcas and the Barnabases and the Aquilas and the Priscillas of the Lord's kingdom, but we would find, not named for us, but described, we would find unruly saints. Isn't that amazing? To which we are told to admonish them. That would be our duty. We also would find those that are faint-hearted. To which the exhortation is to encourage them. To Barnabas them, I guess we could say. We'd also find the weak, to which we were exhorted to help. And though I have some people that look physically weak, and that's probably what some of this meant, I don't believe this is simply saying the physically weak. We would also find those that would be spiritually weak. What about this church? The Corinthians. You know, it's always that weird or tough question. When do you stop calling brethren, brethren, if you ever do? What do they have to do to where they're no longer brethren? I know that there are disagreements. I know there are some things that Christians do that I can't find any biblical authority for. And I know there are some that say, well, they're just not our brethren anymore. But here is the Corinthians. And I'm not trying to justify any of it. But you talk about Christians suing one another, the carnal immorality, some of them not even believing in the resurrection of the dead. Look at what they did to the Lord's Supper. And yet Paul refers to them as brethren, church of God. And I think sometimes people get this idea that when you visit the church, Christ Church, that all you're going to find is Dorcas and Barnabas, Quill and Priscilla. And we need to, you're going to meet those people. But we're also going to meet this kind of people. And just as Barnabas needs the Lord, and Dorcas, these people need the Lord. I heard one time this statement that from a preacher that we can't do any type of teaching and preaching because our church is just a mess. I don't want people coming in here and seeing a church that's all a mess. We got to clean all this. Then we can go out there and preach and teach and invite people. Well, I don't think you're going to be very successful because I don't think you understand what the church is. And if you think you need to get rid of all the problems among all the Christians, you'll never invite anyone to church. And when they get here, they're going to be so disappointed because we don't even understand what it is. We've painted an untrue picture. And so that's our lesson this morning. Go ahead and take a songbook, turn a song of invitation. We want those unruly, those faint-hearted, the weak. The reason those exhortations are there is to help them to rise to the level of a Dorcas or Barnabas or the others we've talked about. And maybe there's one here this morning that needs to become a Christian, needs to begin their walk with the Lord. We have everything you need to baptize you into Christ, to complete that plan of salvation. Maybe there's one that's weak and we can pray with you and we can help you. But let that be known as together we stand and as we sing.